We've already discussed some aspects of how contradictions can enter into a discussion of ideology through Terborn. The fact that he has these many different dimensions in and of itself opens the possibility that they don't all fit together well. But he also presents what I think is a pretty interesting general approach to the transformation of ideology, which centers on what might be characterized as an intergenerational perspective on ideological contradiction. The grounding for this is the following. The transformation of ideology always presupposes an existing ideology. It's never the case that people don't live in a world of ideology. That is, people always are formed as social subjects with answers to these questions: what exists, what is good, and what is possible. They're always formed as subjects. The question of how new ideologies emerge and are disseminated is never a question of how people are turned from non-subjects into subjects. It's always a question of how they're transformed from one kind of subject, that is, a social subject with particular answers to those questions, into another. To understand change, we must understand the conditions under which a given form of subjectivity is not simply passed from one generation to another. And Terborn sees these changes as occurring particularly when there is a disjuncture between generations in the pace at which social change is occurring and the patterns of intergenerational transmission of ideologies. Let me just quote from him on this point. A parental generation will always mold its children according to its own form of subjectivity. That's the first claim, that parents will always form their children according to their own answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible. Where the expression mold its children means through discursive and non-discursive affirmations and sanctions. It's the same set of mechanisms. And if ecological, demographic, socioeconomic, and any intersocietal relationships remain the same, the younger generation will face exactly the same affirmations and sanctions of the existing ideologies as the parental one. It follows that the explanation of the generation of ideologies will have to start from processes of change in the structure of a given society. It is these changes, then, which constitute the material determination of the rise of ideologies. That is, new ideologies will emerge when the affirmations and sanctions that are the result of changes in the structure of a society no longer correspond to the forms of subjection of the previous generation. That will create the context in which, then, new ideologies can be inserted into a population. The actual process by which those new ideologies arise will be some combination of individuals modifying their own beliefs in light of their own immediate experiences of affirmation and sanction, and new messages, new content being communicated to them by social actors trying to transform people's beliefs. Their ability to be successful in that effort will depend upon the extent to which there are disjunctures between the affirmations and sanctions that people experience and the beliefs which they hold. This is in contrast, Terborn argues, to an idealist view which, quote, assumes that just through the power of ideological imagination, each new generation of humans can emancipate themselves from ideological formation of their parents, even though facing exactly the same situations as the latter. So what Terborn rejects is the view that if a new generation faces exactly the same affirmations and sanctions as the parents did, that just through an act of will, people can transform the ideologies that are prevalent in the population. That new ideologies will have bite, will become tractable, will help animate new subjectivities when they enter a situation where the prior forms of subjectivity are no longer being consistently affirmed and sanctioned in discursive and non-discursive ways in the society. That's an empirical claim about how people's subjectivity changes. It's a prediction. It says that where you have a stable society that's in an equilibrium, where there's a continual in everyday life micro-reinforcement of the forms of subjectivity of the prior generation, that's going to be a very difficult context in which to attempt to transform the subjectivities of the actors through deliberate efforts. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering then, what's the mechanism for that's changing the actual realities that are dictating those possibilities? I mean, if it's not individual agency and people changing the qualification process based on their beliefs about the world, then what's changing?
Well, so examples would be the way in which technological changes, which are introduced under the existing ideological structures. So people with the existing subjectivities and forms of action that are consistent with the affirmations and sanctions introduce new technologies which disrupt the way in which jobs are formed and opportunities occur, which create power imbalances in the countryside that enable landowners to displace peasants who then no longer face the same affirmations and sanctions as they did before because the social structure has been transformed.
But I guess what I'm saying is that aren't some of those technologies developed because they're imagining possibilities for subjectivity beyond what currently exists? I mean, are they saying to them, or, you know, imagining possibilities for the world? I mean, they're imagining technologies that are either like safer or more productive, or imagining workers that relate to those technologies in different ways.
Imagining a technological change does not in any way violate, that is, the answer to the question what exists, what is good, and what is possible includes the possibility of new technologies, certainly in a capitalist context. One of the things that is viewed as possible is continual new technologies. What exists is a world in which science and research and development introduces new technologies. And what is good, it's a good thing to have technical change. So the production of new technologies falls firmly within the existing forms of subjectivity created in capitalism. Some of those new technologies will have the consequence, however, of destroying sectors and leading people who were previously thought they had stable jobs forever being without work and no longer having skills that are suitable for employment in the existing structure. So the consequence of an introduction of a new technology can be a complete disruption of social relations, even though the new technology was perfectly congruent with the existing ideology. What Terborn is saying is that social structures have that kind of contradiction in them. If they don't, if they're in a kind of equilibrium that is self-reinforcing and self-reproducing without contradiction, then there would be no space for ideological change either. Just to give one other example, in the transition from feudalism to capitalism, feudal lords had certain kinds of power, which they derive from their position within feudal social structures. As markets expanded slowly in feudalism, new opportunities for using that power, still within feudalism, occurred, which led landowners under certain circumstances to try to displace peasants. So there was a continual class struggle in feudalism over the land between landowners and peasants. Sometimes the peasants were strong enough to resist, sometimes not. as those continual struggles intersected slow changes in the market, one of the things that happened was that fields became enclosed and common lands were destroyed and taken over by landowners. That provoked a huge change in social structure, which then created a context for new ideologies to emerge. But the contradictions were in the social structure. It's because of power and struggles over resources and land and whatever, as opposed to a pure ideological entrepreneur through the sheer force of imagination being able to change people's views in the absence of any significant contradictions in the social structure. Yeah?
Gary. Well, I mean, I guess I'm a little confused because what do you mean by contradictions? So the fact that sanctions and affirmations exist, or because, like, when I think about this ideological thing, I think, well, couldn't people just reinterpret the way that the meaning of sanctions and affirmations, and through that, like, you don't have new technologies developing or anything like that. You just take the idea of, like, the spread of a religion, for example. So maybe they interpret things as different than other things, and they redesign their society.
Right, so that's what Terborn is rejecting, the hypothesis that you could have a spread of religion that would take over a society in which it was the case that the affirmations and sanctions of everyday life were not disrupted. That is, there'd be no point of entry for that religion. Now, one way you could is if you also conquered the society. Right? So how did Islam spread? It had spread through conquest. It wasn't just that these ideas suddenly became attractive to new communities, that people were perfectly happy with their old polytheistic religions or Hinduism or whatever it was, and that the social relations of production were in correspondence to these ideological subjectivities, and that they heard these new ideas and they thought, oh great, that sounds like a better society. That's not how it happened. It happened by conquest and imposition. And that's always...
What about Marxism?
But Marxism occurs in a world in which the system of affirmations and sanctions around ideologies is constantly being disrupted by capitalism. I mean, it's precisely because, and where it isn't, Marxism doesn't have much traction. I mean, Marxism doesn't have much traction in a well-functioning capitalism in which workers, if they do their jobs well, get stable incomes and have good security. You know, if you have a capitalism with very muted contradictions, where the systems of reproduction have effectively neutralized the ways in which capitalism constantly fails to live up to its own promise for individuals, in that kind of stable form of capitalism.
What is the promise of capitalism?
That individuals who work hard and play by the rules will have, workers will have a stable standard of living. If most workers in the 1950s in the United States, for white workers, if they worked hard and followed by the rules, they had their wages went up 4 or 5% a year, and they had very low risk of unemployment. That was correct. And that's what capitalism said it would do, and it's what it did do. And it makes revolutionary ideologies not very attractive to most people. And it wasn't that they were, that wasn't false consciousness on that part. That was actually the case for most people. Not for everybody, but for most people.
I guess I was just going to say, though, do most people really believe that because they're born in a capitalist society, their life is going to get better as they get older or something?
Well, it was true that most people, it's true for most people that they earn more at age 50 than age 30.
But I think that most people understand at least somewhat the way capitalist society works. When they don't get a job, they go, well, you know, it is the way that the society works. It's not like a rejection of the normal affirmation.
Right, but there's reasons why Marxism makes bigger gains in the 1930s, mm-hmm. right, when the system breaks down and the normal expectations as to what happens when you behave in a particular way are not confirmed by the consequences of your actions. That's the context in which people can say, look, the reason why this is occurring is not because of any failure on your part, but because the system isn't working.
And that was the point that I was going to make. But the system was working. Well, I mean, I guess I don't know too much about history, but I mean, we do have capitalism does have breakdowns, and that's a normal part of the system, right? I mean, and that's just Marxism saying, okay, no, you got to understand it in this particular way, and that instead of understanding it as, this is going to happen. This is going to lead to a breakdown. Let's say in capitalism eventually is going to like that.
So Marxism gives a very strong interpretation of these periodic breakdowns as being symptomatic of some long-term fundamental problem. That argument has credibility to people, much more credibility to people in the midst of a breakdown than it does in the midst of a boom and prosperity and stable prosperity. In the midst of a boom and prosperity, it sounds like just a point of view. You know, it sounds just like somebody else's view, and most people don't give it credibility because in their daily experience, the predictions of the radical view are not being affirmed. I mean, I don't think this isn't a complicated point. That what Terborn is saying is that ideologies don't change by a sheer act of will on the part of some charismatic ideological leader unless it corresponds to a disjuncture between how a system represents itself and how people experience it, which then allows for a reinterpretation. If everything corresponds, then such reinterpretations are not possible. And further, he adds this intergenerational point, which I think is a good one, is that the people most vulnerable to a transformation of their views are people who are just reaching adult, sort of young adults are the population whose affirmations and sanctions have not so deeply inscribed a set of subjective beliefs about what exists, what is good, and what is possible. And if they face different sanctions and affirmations from their parents, that's the context in which their interpolations can be most dramatically changed. And I think historically it is probably the case that on average ideological transformations occur more often in young adults than they do in people who have been steadfastly in one ideological mode for most of their lives and then change in their 50s and 60s. And he's providing reasons why that would be the case. There were some other questions here.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand when you talk about reinterpretations, whether those reinterpretations are byproducts of the structural disjuncture, or if people need to know them before the disjuncture, so they already know that there are alternatives to the ideological setting.
I don't think the theory is clear enough to distinct to make a claim about that. If there's a period of disjuncture, people may be more receptive to new interpretations that they hadn't heard before. So it's not just that they have them in the back of their mind and now they have credibility. But it's also probably the case that having a set of alternative interpretations as part of the general kind of cultural context or ideological context, even before a disjuncture, makes it more likely that when a disjunction occurs, people will be available, so to speak, for new interpretations. But Terreborn doesn't make a clear, doesn't take a stand on that issue.
Because it relates to political entrepreneurship to some extent. It would, if we assume that human interpretations are only byproducts of structures,
No, what he would say, his point is that the broad acceptance and dissemination of new interpretations is a byproduct of changing structures. Not that, I don't think he would be making an even stronger case that no one can propose new interpretations except when there is a disjuncture. That would be a much stronger claim. So he's not, he rejects the idealist view that says just through the power of ideological imagination, each new generation can emancipate themselves. But he doesn't reject the importance of ideological imagination. Just the claim that just through ideological imagination, emancipation is possible. Tyler.
I just want to cut, I don't know whether you would agree, and also this, at this point of this juncture, the interpretation of ideology also depends on the context. I mean, different ideologies are interpreted differently in different contexts. For instance, I mean, let's say Marxism, we've been talking about that. It takes the form of Maoism in China, Castroism in Latin America, in national independence movements in Africa, Eurocommunism in Europe.
There's
a response coming from the particular society in terms of interpretation of that ideology while it's spreading.
And so this may just be quibbling about words. Do we want to say there is an ideology and then multiple interpretations, or there are multiple ideologies that use the same words? It doesn't seem to me that the ideology of North Korea and the ideology of Eurocommunism are the same ideology, just different interpretations. They are the same, they use some of the same words, but the whole meaning of those words are different. So to describe that as just a different interpretation of the same thing, as opposed to fundamentally different answers to the question, what exists, what is possible, and what is good. So the European democratic socialists who draw on Marxism, when they talk about deep democracy, they mean something utterly and totally different from what the North Korean regime means when they say that they're a democratic society. It just, the words just don't mean the same thing. So I wouldn't myself describe that as different interpretations, but rather just as different and fundamentally different forms of subject formation that happen to use some of the same words and symbols.
Well, the example might be weak. I mean, I'm not insisting on that. But what do you say? I just wanted to ask your opinion about these different interpretations. Is there a room for that?
Well, sure, but that's just what this framework allows us for a huge amount of variation in the answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible. And the study of the way in which those answers are formed and come to be believed or disbelieved by people. And one form of variation would be variations that one could describe as different interpretations of the same words or whatever. And the same discourses could have different interpretations. But I'm not sure what's at stake in deciding that we're going to describe something as a different interpretation as opposed to just a variation. What this intergenerational issue brings up is a understudied problem in social theory in general, which is has rich potentials for research agendas, which centers around the importance of the pace of social change or the temporality of social change for understanding the character of the changes themselves. Certain things become possible if they're done rapidly that are not possible if they're done slowly. It matters whether industrialization, for example, takes place over three generations or over one generation. There's a fantastic book, one of the best books in historical sociology that I know, called The Fabrication of Labor by Richard Bernanke. I consider it the single best piece of historical sociology dealing with culture, The Fabrication of Labor. It's a comparison of German and English workers in the 19th century in terms of their relationship to Marxism. And the core of the analysis is the following. If you go back to medieval times, there was very little difference between German and English laborers in artisanal production in terms of their views about the nature of work, the nature of the labor process, and their relationships to the masters in the artisanal production systems. By the middle of the 19th century, there's a huge difference between the way German and English workers think about this problem. The explanation that Bernanke offers is the following, that between the destruction of the feudal form of artisanal labor in England and the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, there were five generations. That took 150 years. It was a very slow process where you had a destruction of the old forms, a long period of independent small artisanal producers operating in the market, and then the creation of capitalist firms. Five generations between the two. In Germany, there was an overlap. That is, the emergence of industrial capitalism with factories and large workshops occurred overlapping the disintegration of the older feudal-based guild system and the like. So there was this, there was no interregnum between these two systems. The result is that in Germany, feudal understandings of the artisan-master relationship carried over into capitalism because there was no period for an autonomous petty bourgeois conception of that relationship to be forged through a slower process of cultural transformation and learning. Whereas in England, there was this long period. And then he derives all sorts of interesting propositions about the differences between things, including, for example, peace rates were calculated differently in Germany and in Britain in the same kinds of factories. And the difference was whether peace rates were calculated on the basis of how do you define a piece? You know, what's a piece? If you're in textiles, what's a piece? Is it a yard of cloth or is it a certain number of threads that have passed through? Now, a thread that's gone back and forth is a measure of labor motion, whereas a yard of cloth is a measure of product, right? And I can't reconstruct for you which is which, but in one country, piece rates were calculated by the motions of the laborer, and in the other by the quantity of the product. And that this he derives from these different understandings of what the nature of labor and the nature of work and the relationship to employers, and he explains it by the temporality of change. So this is a case where I think Terborn's analysis is absolutely perfect for it. You've got different answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible by German and British workers as it pertains to this domain, labor process and work. In the medieval period, they have the same answers to the question. In the capitalist period, they have different answers to the question. The reason, and the Germans have more continuity with the medieval understandings. The British have more discontinuity. And the reason is the temporality of change. That is that the British workers could develop a different understanding because of many generations of new self-understanding that emerged through independent petty bourgeois artisanal production, which did not exist in Germany. It's a terrific book. I recommend it to everybody.
Okay.
I'd like to at least begin the mystification discussion. There's a lot more in the Terreborn than what I've discussed here. Those are the key ideas, but I do think it's absolutely a book that's worth reading the other parts as well. It's not that long, and it's worth the time. So, now I want to shift gears to three other terms that get used a lot in discussions of ideology, which we'll be discussing in this lecture, the rest of this lecture, and the next. We may well end up having to spill over beyond the time allotted for this in order to get all these ideas clearly out. There's three terms: mystification, legitimation, and hegemony. These are three terms that get used a lot in discussions of ideology: mystification, legitimation, and hegemony. Roughly speaking, I think there's a correspondence between these three terms and Terreborn's three modes of interpolation. Mystification concerns an analysis of what exists, that is, in the ideological interpolation that Terreborn discusses under the heading "What Exists," that's where the analysis of mystification falls. Legitimation falls under the rubric "What is good?" Legitimation is all about evaluations of the desirability of alternatives, of arrangements. And hegemony is above all about the problem of what is possible. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, particularly for hegemony, but I think it's a rough correspondence that will serve our purposes. So here I want to talk about mystification. Mystification I would define as distortions of perceptions of reality that mask or obscure that reality. To have a mystified view of things is not merely to have a distorted view, but to have a distorted view that also has the consequences of obscuring what you're seeing. Not all distortions have that quality, right? So when you take a stick and put it into water at an angle, it looks bent. Now, no one, even before people understood optics, we understand now why it appears bent. It's because of angles of refraction with light passing through water and air. But even before we understood optics, I don't believe any person in a pre-modern scientific culture, when they stuck a stick into water and saw it look bent, believed it actually was bent. They didn't know why it appeared distorted in that way. They had no account for it. I'm sure they had folk beliefs as to what was going on. But nobody, that was not a distortion which actually had the effect of leading to a incorrect view about the shape of the stick. It's not that they felt it bent when it got in the water and it magically unbent when it got out. They said, I don't know why this is happening, but somehow or other it looks bent when it's in water. Now that's different from the problem with the sun setting around the earth. That was a case where people sat on the hillside, watched the sun moving towards the horizon, and actually thought that it meant that the sun was going down towards the horizon. Until Copernicus, then, the misperception was a mystification. And that's because it became backed by a set of beliefs about the relationship between the earth and the sun that distorted and obscured the actual relation between the earth and the sun. Today, when you sit on the hillside and watch the sun set, you perfectly well understand that it's a consequence of the relative size of you and the earth and the rotation of the earth on its axis, and it doesn't cause you any angst. I mean, I'm sure none of you have watched a sunset and thought, oh my God, this is so terrible. The sun looks like it's moving around the earth, but I know it's not true. What am I going to do? There was a time when that shattered people's sense of their being in the universe. And people were burned at the stake over that issue. Right? Over the issue, does or does not the sun rotate around the earth? And the earth rotate around its axis. It was a very big deal. The demystification of that misperception was a traumatic process in the history of science and religion. It was, you know, the next time something like that happened was Darwin. You know, there were these two big episodes in the history of the relationship between religion and science in the West, which have caused endless agony for people. The first was Copernicus. By the time of Darwin, I don't think there were any deeply religious people who were disturbed by the fact that the Earth rotated around the sun and around its axis. You know, that was no longer a source of disquiet. Even though the Catholic Church only apologized for Galileo's persecution a few years ago. I mean, the official, what?
1992.
Yeah, so only in 1992 was there an official recognition that that was, you know, an unjustified persecution. So it took a while, but centuries before that, it was no longer a source of any moral anguish. But Darwin is still today a source of moral anguish, you know, philosophical anguish for lots of people. But I'm sure for none of you. Well, what I would say is, there was a time when we had very powerful ideologies of nature that were at war with the science of nature and which battled to repress the science of nature in ways that were mystifying, that largely that battle has been won, that ideologies of nature no longer have that character, that we all still have ideologies of nature. We all, as human subjects living in the world, hold beliefs about what exists and what is possible, maybe about what is good in nature, although the what is good question about nature per se has dropped out as a major kind of moral issue in the way it was at one time in the past, and except perhaps for certain strands of environmentalism pose the question, what is good in nature, separate from what is good for people in nature. I don't want to get into that confusing discussion. We no longer really have a serious mystification of nature, I think, in our ideologies of nature. So most people can calmly acknowledge that their subjective experience of nature doesn't correspond to their beliefs about nature without that being a problem. That is, our beliefs are no longer obscured by our perceptions in the way that they were. We can accept there being a gap between the two. What that means is that we've had a demystification of the ideologies of nature. It's still the case that you see the sun setting, you don't see the earth rotating. But you can hold the scientific belief as your ideology of nature, that is, the content of your belief about the relationship of the earth and the sun is a scientific one, and you can see the sun going towards the horizon. Well, social mystification concerns aspects about our beliefs about the way social relations work, which obscure and hide the true nature of those social relations. In Marx's analysis, the sharpest example where he discusses these things are in his discussion of commodity fetishism, and also what's sometimes called capital fetishism. Marx's analysis of fetishism are fairly complex and difficult. Before discussing them, which I think I'll do next Monday, Let me just give two other examples of mystifications in social contexts that are simpler than the commodity fetishism example. So here's one kind of mystification of in our social beliefs. What I would call individualistic explanations of individual acts. Consider a poverty. We observe that some people are poor and some people are well off. That's a simple observation of the world. That doesn't require any special theoretical knowledge or classification systems. It's a simple observation that some people live much, much better and other people live quite poorly. We also observe that some people who are born poor become well off, and some do not. That's also just a straight observation, an empirical observation about the world. It's an empirical observation which both Marxists and conservative economists can acknowledge. Since some people who are born poor become well off and some do not, since these individuals differ in their outcomes, the causes of these outcomes must be borne by the individual. So what if we have two brothers who are born in the same family and one becomes rich and the other stays poor? There must be some difference between these two brothers that explains why one becomes rich and one becomes poor. So we explain the poverty of one brother by an attribute of that brother that differs from the attribute of the brother who becomes rich. By extension, we explain poverty by the aggregation of the attributes of people who are poor and explain those who become rich by the attributes of those people who become rich. The structural basis for the existence of poverty is opaque and ignored. Exploitation, class, domination, and so on. Now, the ideological mystification here comes from the translation of an observation which is part of lived experience, the simple lived experience observation, that people individually differ and these differences correspond to differences in outcomes, we observe that, to a explanation for the outcomes which attributes it to individual differences. The same thing can be done for crime. We observe that some poor people commit crimes, some robberies, some don't. It must be because the people who commit crimes are different from the people who do, since not everybody does. We observe variations between persons that correspond to variations in these acts. And we therefore assume that crime is explained by the attributes of the persons who commit crimes. Now, since every crime is committed by a person who commits the crime, so to speak, and persons have motivations and attributes, and they could have not committed it, it is a choice, it's something that people do, it seems like a reasonable thing to just explain the phenomenon, the acts, by the attributes of the persons. Again, this is a mystification because it incorrectly